You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Caudette. All through 2020, our reporter roundtable has been covering all of the news that made headlines this past year. So today, in our end-of-year reporter roundtable, we will break down 2020. So let's go all the way back to January, before elections, before COVID, and even before the Idaho legislature started writing bills. Here's Governor Brad Little during his State of the State address talking about investing in reentry facilities and more probation and parole officers instead of building a $500 million prison.
We have a choice. We can either invest in measures designed to reduce the demand for prison beds and promote safer communities, or we can do nothing and ensure the next check we write is larger than the last.
And that is just one of the stories we covered in 2020. With us today to look back on this year are Kevin Richert with Idaho Ed News, Mike Sharp, executive producer with Idaho News 6, Rebecca Boone, supervisory correspondent with the Associated Press Bureau, Boise Bureau, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, and Don Day, founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Scott McIntosh, the opinion editor at the Idaho Statesman. Whew, welcome, everybody.
Thanks,
hey, Gemma.
Hello.
So, Jimmy, let's go back to the start of the legislative session real quick, because even though, yes, coronavirus was starting to be talked about at this point when the session started, you know, it had not, at least in reports, made its way to the United States yet. Definitely Idaho had not seen its first case yet. So, you know, the focus every January normally is on what's going on in the legislature.
Right, exactly. And yeah, a billion years ago in January.
Right.
You know, this kind of State of the State speech really started out with, you know, every year we actually get kind of a preview of what is going on in the budget just before he gives his speech. And what we saw was this 2% cut to state agencies, seemingly out of nowhere. But the Little administration couched it as, hey, look, you know, it's been a while since we've had a recession. We've been, you know, kind of rolling along. Idaho's economy has been doing pretty well so far, but we need to prepare a little bit more. And so that was kind of, you know, the overarching theme, I thought, of the budget. And that's what I thought was going to be one of the bigger stories, while also investing in K-12 education and reentry services, like we heard him talk about at the top.
And also in the midst of this in January, Rebecca, there is a story that is making national and international headlines. And no, it's not COVID. It is the case of Lori Vailo and Chad Daybell and the disappearance of two of Lori's children. And this really, especially here in Idaho, was consuming the news cycle because it seemed, frankly, just impossible. It was a story like no other.
Right. And so this started even back before that, but it didn't really hit the national news until around January. 17-year-old Tylee Ryan and her brother, 7-year-old Joshua J.J. Vailo, were last seen in September of 2019, right? And extended family members contacted police. They're like, we're worried about these kids. They contacted Rexburg Police specifically in eastern Idaho. Rexburg Police started searching, and it just seemed to kind of languish there for a while. But as we learned more and more about the case, it just got weirder and weirder. The children's mother, Lori Vailo, now Lori Daybell, and her new husband, Chad Daybell, reportedly lied to police about the children's whereabouts when police went to the home to ask. Then they sort of, and this was all in 2019, then they sort of like left town, and nobody really knew where they went. And then they were found in Hawaii months later. So they sort of quietly left Idaho. They were found in Hawaii. They had gotten married at some point. They both had spouses that had died recently in sort of like unexpected circumstances. And these kids were missing. Eventually authorities arrested Lori Daybell. She's been in jail since February, and she was charged initially with child abandonment and obstructing the investigation into where these kids had gone. But in June, things took sort of a more sinister turn, right? Police continued to search for Tylee and JJ, and they found the remains in the backyard of Chad Daybell. They'd been, you know, buried, and one of the bodies had been burned. And so both Lori and Chad were charged with additional charges, mainly destroying evidence, because we still don't know exactly what circumstances led to the children's death. This all is sinister enough, right? But the case actually spans several states and goes back to mid-2019, when Lori Daybell's brother, Alex Cox, shot and killed her then estranged husband, Charles Vallow, in suburban Phoenix. At the time, Alex Cox said it was self-defense. Charles Vallow had been seeking a divorce from Lori. The divorce documents and filings said all sorts of strange things, including that Lori believed she had become a godlike figure who was responsible for ushering in the biblical end times. Some other testimony that's come out since then in connection to the new charges is that some witnesses have said that Lori Vallow referred to her children as zombies. In other words, that they had sort of been somehow turned to the dark side, or that their souls were gone in some way, and that they were sort of obstructing potentially her work, you know, godly work mm-hmm. here on earth or something. It's all very confusing. Witnesses also said that Chad Daybell, you know, believed that he had like some sort of communication. He could talk to people behind the veil, meaning like people who had died, and that he was maybe also part of this alleged zombie versus good theory. It's all a very unusual case. Both Lori and Chad Daybell have pleaded not guilty to these charges, and they maintain their innocence, and the trial has not yet happened yet. So that will come probably this coming year in 2021. Meanwhile, there's a whole other investigation going on into the cause of death for Tammy Daybell. That's Chad's previous wife. She died in her sleep last October of what her obituary said were natural causes, but authorities then grew suspicious because, of course, Chad and Lori Daybell got married mm-hmm. just a few weeks later. So they had Tammy Daybell's body exhumed. The results of that autopsy have not yet been released. We don't know if it'll ultimately come out to anything or not, but that's something else that authorities are looking at in this case.
So now I want to go to, let's take it way back again to February and March, and going back to the legislature with transgender bills that frankly dominated the news, made some national headlines. Scott, talk to us about these, because, you know, pre-COVID, this too was making big headlines.
Yeah, and who knew that transgender rights was going to become such a hot topic in the legislature? It really kind of came out of nowhere, but Idaho's Republican legislators brought forth no fewer than three bills related to transgender rights. One of them, probably the one that got the most attention, was a bill that prohibited transgender girls and women from participating in girls and women's sports. And it was presented as a bill that created fairness or protected fairness for girls and women in sports. And there was a lot of heated debate about it. It eventually passed and was signed into law by the governor. The second one was another bill that prohibited transgender individuals from changing the gender listed on their birth certificates. And again, this had a lot of heated testimony, but was eventually passed by the legislature and signed into law by the governor. The third bill was a bill that would have criminalized medical treatment of transgender minors. And same thing, this was in committee, and dozens of people testified, transgender individuals, families, doctors, medical experts testified. The chairman of that committee, Representative Greg Cheney, Republican chair of the House Judiciary Rules and Administration Committee, he announced that he would hold the bill in committee. And part of it, he said he was moved by the testimony that he heard. But that bill essentially got killed in that session. But the other two bills, like I said, were passed and signed into law by the governor. However, shortly after they took effect in August, the bills, both bills went into the court system, and a federal judge stopped the state from implementing the ban on transgender athletes. So granted a temporary injunction while that challenge moves through the court system. And similarly with the other bill that banned transgender individuals from changing the gender on their birth certificates, that also had a legal challenge as expected. And Magistrate Judge Candy Dale ruled in August that this violated an injunction from 2018 that everyone knew about. It was a federal injunction that told the state of Idaho that you couldn't do this, but the legislators passed this bill anyway, and sure enough, it ended up back in court and was the subject of an injunction. So those two bills are still moving through the court system, and a lot of people suspect that they will not survive court challenges. Even our own Idaho Attorney General has said that these are not going to withstand court challenges. So those are still developing, and we'll see how those end up in court. But I think it's surprised a lot of people that transgender rights became such a hot topic in the legislature this year.
We're going to have more with our end of year reporter roundtable in just a moment. So much more to get to. Haven't even begun to discuss the pandemic. But first, here's another news story that we covered in 2020. Idaho Representative John Green was expelled from the Idaho legislature after he was convicted of a felony. Here's House Speaker Scott Bedke.
Today was a solemn and difficult day for the Idaho House of Representatives.
More Idaho Matters next. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Caudette. It is our end of the year reporter roundtable, and here's another news story we covered in 2020 that made national headlines. George Floyd's death on May 31st sparked protests around the country and here in Idaho. Anthony Bruner and Shayla Browning attended Boise's first major protest in front of the state capitol.
Obviously, we all watch George Floyd die right in front of our faces. You know, I mean, that's, it don't matter if he was white, Hispanic, or whatever, like, don't nobody deserve to die like that.
We're hurt, we're sad, this is nothing new. And I can say this a million times, but as a black person, this is nothing new. Our people have been killed for years and years and years for sometimes no reason at all.
Our guest today, Kevin Richert with Idaho Ed News, Mike Sharp, executive producer with Idaho News 6, Rebecca Boone, supervisory correspondent with the Associated Press Boise Bureau, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, Don Day, founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Scott McIntosh, the opinion editor at the Idaho Statesman. As I just mentioned, the killing of George Floyd happened on May 31st, but we need to go back to end of February, first part of March, when all of a sudden COVID-19 takes over news headlines. In Idaho, we see our first confirmed case on March 13th. So let's go back to those early days. And Jimmy, maybe we can start with you and really where we were at that point.
Yeah. So we had been hearing headlines, obviously all across the country. New York City was about to, or had already been in its sort of emergency situation. Across the world, we had Italy, on fire, basically, a bunch of other European countries as well. And it was kind of a weird feeling at the Idaho Capitol. There were no precautions being taken, really. No one was wearing masks. Social distancing wasn't really a thing. Even before March 13th, that was when I decided to report remotely from my home, as opposed to being down in the Capitol. But there were just a lot of questions, and no one was really prepared. I think that I reported this story on Howard Guidry Jr., who was a 54-year-old man in Boise. He had lots of prior health issues. And in March, he had fallen and hurt himself at home, had a spinal injury, and was taken to St. Al's Hospital. And while he was there, he developed some kind of respiratory illness, not really sure what it was. Doctors, I believe, thought it was pneumonia. And he ultimately died shortly after that diagnosis on March 8th, which was 5 days before the first confirmed case. But at the time, testing was extremely scarce. They never tested Howard before or after he died. And something that's kind of unthinkable now when we're talking about respiratory illnesses, his family, who had tons of pre-existing conditions, were all gathered in his room, no masks, no anything for 2 hours, just so they could be with, you know, his body and say their final goodbyes. You know, he and his wife Felicity had just gotten married after being on and off for many, many years. And after that, and after Idaho finally got its first case, something clicked in her head. Oh, is this what happened? You know, and just sheer panic kind of picked up for her and her kids and her parents who could have picked it up. And, you know, this is a story that happened all across the country. Family member gets sick, but, you know, testing is scarce and limited. We had no idea of the magnitude. Thankfully, you know, Felicity and her family did make it through that quarantine. But, you know, it was an extremely scary time for them and still is for a lot of people today. And the thing is that this is still happening to some extent. You know, you have asymptomatic people who still can't get tested. Turnaround times on tests, depending on where you live, can still be lengthy to the point of, you know, it's kind of useless if it's, you know, 10, 14 days after you take the test. How do you know who you came into contact with, et cetera? So in some ways, things have gotten better. You know, obviously, for the detriment of families, you can't be in the hospital room in those final moments, unfortunately, to say goodbye, you know, maybe through FaceTime or something. But, you know, as things change, things still stay the same, I think.
And Kevin, in March, on March 23rd, I believe, is when the State Board of Ed closed all K through 12 public schools until April 20th at that point. Talk about that from your perspective, because here you are covering the legislature like you do every year, and then bam, this hits, schools close down, but schools have to figure out a way to still teach.
Exactly. And it came right on the heels of that bizarre end of the legislative session, and Jimmy alluded to it. You had, you know, this dichotomy where you had several legislators who did decide to leave the session early because they were concerned about their health, but you had legislators who were still, you know, going to a party at the Basque Center the Tuesday before the session. So that's your backdrop. Now, the Monday after the legislature adjourns, the State Board of Education meets and very abruptly decides, you know, when you, in response to the dozens of school districts that had decided, you know, we're going to close indefinitely, the State Board said, well, let's close all schools. Let's take that decision and, you know, leave it so the school districts don't have to worry about that. So in effect, that closed schools through the spring and started us on this long process that is still ongoing with school districts and, you know, trustees and superintendents trying to figure out, well, where do we go from here? And we've seen it in Boise, we've seen it in West Ada, we've seen it all across the state. Districts really struggling with trying to maintain online, trying to maintain face-to-face learning, or having to shift to some form of online learning or some combination of the two. It's been a very complicated issue, a very controversial matter at the local and state level. And as long as the coronavirus is raging, this is going to be a raging controversy in schools.
And then Dawn and Mike, on March 25th, Governor Little puts a stay home order in place for the state of Idaho. Here in the city of Boise, there were even stricter rules in place. So let's talk about the economy, because and Dawn, why don't we start with you, and Mike, feel free to chip in. But at first, Dawn, this was like, okay, 3 weeks, all right, you know, just go get carry out. It frankly seemed a bit surreal, but not devastating.
Yeah, you know, I've told this anecdote, and I might have told it on the show. I was at Boise City Hall in February, and a reporter for the Statesman was there, and they were asking some stories about the coronavirus, which was known at the time, but didn't seem to be a big threat. And the reporter and the city's at the time spokesperson kind of looked over at me because they wanted to have a conversation about, you know, their reporting. And I just go, I'm not reporting on coronavirus. You guys can talk in front of me, like no big deal, right? Yeah, it turned out that I was wrong and everybody was wrong. And I think it got more serious as we went along. But yeah, the impacts to the economy, we just didn't know what was going to happen. And we didn't know where things were going to go. I'm looking at the unemployment chart for the year. And you can look at that unemployment rate statewide in Idaho in February at 2.7%, nearing an all-time low. And then by April, it was at 11.8%. But then as the year goes along, it's actually trended down, and we're now between 5 and 6% statewide, although there could be some challenges in days and weeks to come. And I think you talk about that sort of like, oh, we thought this wasn't going to be a big deal. Mm-hmm. And it did feel weird. That first week, you know, I think of that Friday the 13th that we all experienced together. You know, Tom Hanks, the story about Tom Hanks came out, and the NBA shut down, and then everything else shut down. And locally, we were all kind of giving side eye to Treefort, like, hey, you guys going to keep going or what's going to happen? But everybody thought, well, this will be a short-term thing and this will go away quickly. And that's just not turned out to be the case. Businesses have had whiplash across the state, I think, in so many ways. Many of them closed. Restaurants and shops, the mall was closed, which is just crazy to me, and the Village at Meridian. You couldn't get your hair cut. And really, the only places you could go was the grocery store. And then everything kind of opened back up, and we had this sort of surreal summer. But now as we get into kind of the coldest part of the year, things are starting to shut down again. And we're starting to have businesses fail. And we've been tracking this, and we're seeing a lot of businesses close. And businesses don't often say why they've closed, but you can sort of see the trend in an increasing number of these closures and think, boy, I wonder what's going to happen in 2021 for our economy as a whole, for our wage workers and our business owners.
And Mike, in fact, you know, Don mentioned unemployment. Didn't claims like go surpass what we've seen, what we saw in 2019 already?
Right. So the first few weeks of the shutdown, we saw more unemployment claims or new unemployment claims than the entire year of 2019. The way I saw it described to me was it was like a car driving into a brick wall. The economy just stopped. People lost their jobs quickly. People, even those who kept their jobs, some of them were still earning unemployment because of the inability to work. It was remarkable. And, you know, Don talks about the way we all were kind of wrong about covering COVID and mm-hmm. the coronavirus. I think just like the economy, just like every business, just like the government, journalists have been learning on the fly and trying to figure this out. I mean, you look back, that first positive case that came down and the way everybody jumped on it, and you know, the work that we did trying to figure out who was getting it, what businesses may have been affected, trying to track those things down. It's remarkable looking back now, considering how many tens of thousands of cases the state has had, the deaths that have passed 1,000 at this point, when that initial death was one that everybody covered in a way that I think if we could all go back and see the context and see how bad things would get, we may handle things a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. But the economy stopping the way it did, it affected not just unemployment claims, but the state itself was ill-equipped to handle that. And we covered a lot of detail into the way the Idaho Department of Labor and the state handled those initial claims. People weren't getting through. People were waiting hours and hours and hours on the phone. The governor at that point was our lifeline with these virtual press conferences to get us information. The only opportunity to really push and try to find out exactly what was going on, why people weren't getting access. And everybody was just kind of flailing at that time. Nobody really knew how to handle it, how long it was going to last. I think if we had known it was going to last as long as it did, I think maybe people would have reacted a little slower or more even-handed to make sure that some of the changes and some of the moves that were made would be more long term. But yeah, we have, you know, unemployment benefits. We had people who were concerned about being kicked out of their homes because they weren't able to pay the mortgage or pay the rent, which then begged bigger questions about how the SBA loans were going to work, or the housing loans were going to work. Mm-hmm. The PPP got rolled out and the coronavirus legislation came from the federal government. And there were a lot of questions there. I mean, the economy is largely, I think you could probably argue this any year, but in 2020, the economy is the one thing that seems to connect all of these other stories that we're talking about in the way things happen so suddenly.
We're going to have more with our reporter roundtable next, but first we want to talk about another news story that we covered in 2020 before the pandemic hit the U.S. Michael Bloomberg, remember him? He was campaigning hard across the Mountain West, hoping to secure the Republican nomination. This is Aaron Hudson, the spokesperson for Bloomberg's campaign in Idaho.
We all have the same goal, is to remove Donald Trump from the White House, make sure that he is a one-term president, and get a Democratic president in the White House in November.
And I need to correct myself. Michael Bloomberg was running for that Democratic ticket. Joe Biden was ultimately the winner in Idaho in getting that nomination. More Reporter Roundtable next. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette, and it is the end of the year reporter roundtable. Here's another story we covered in 2020. Back in August, the Idaho legislature met in a special session, and armed protesters showed up.
You guys are in the room. You don't use force and violence.
Those were chants of "Let us in." Continuing with our reporter roundtable, Scott McIntosh, you covered this with the Idaho Statesman. Talk to us a little bit more about well, first off, why there was a special session?
Well, the special session was called because of the coronavirus pandemic, and there were certain things that needed to be addressed by the legislature in terms of specifically the elections and liability reform. And so I think that the elections legislation that Idaho passed during the special session was one of the most important and impactful things that they did. You know, the special session drew a lot of headlines for its controversy, the protesters, the House declaration calling an end to the COVID emergency, which that declaration didn't go anywhere because the Senate didn't pass it. But one of the quieter moves that the legislature made was to allow county clerks to process ballots ahead of Election Day. And, you know, sounds boring, but really, when you think about it, on Election Day this year, we all got results of the election on election night, just like normal, mm-hmm. as if nothing unusual was happening. Well, there was a lot unusual happening. Number one, we had the highest voter turnout that we've had. We had 875,000 people vote. We had we crossed the threshold of 1 million registered voters. And many, many voters voted by mail because of the coronavirus pandemic. People didn't want to show up and vote in person. And so that meant that there were hundreds of thousands of ballots that were mailed in. And in order to process them, it takes a lot of time to process. It may seem like an insignificant thing, but simply processing mailed in ballots is a tedious process. The signature on the outside of the return envelope must be checked and verified. The envelope must be opened. The ballot needs to be removed from the secrecy sleeve. Then the ballot needs to be unfolded and flattened so that it can be fed into a scanner that then digitizes the paper ballot. Now, counting did not take place until Election Day, but doing the prep work ahead of time was instrumental in getting the results so quickly, especially compared with other states. And we saw that, the delayed counting and results of the election follow the week in the days and the weeks following the election caused a lot of heartache in other states. But in Idaho, we acted as if everything was normal. And it was because the legislature wisely allowed those clerks to process those ballots 1 week in advance. And if you look at the numbers, Ada County 4 years ago in 2016 had 25,000 mailed-in ballots. This year, they had 129,000 ballots, almost 130,000 ballots. So a 5-fold increase for Ada County alone. And that allowed us to avoid some of these nightmares that really made some big headlines. And fortunately, this was an opportunity for Idaho to not be in the national headlines on Election Day.
And Kevin, we talked about the pandemic and how it affected K-12 and how it's still affecting K-12. This has also had a huge impact on higher education as well.
In so many different ways, Gemma. There's the budget impact, because higher education, like most state agencies, took a 5% budget hit. And we're seeing that play itself out in the colleges and universities in the form of layoffs, in the form of furloughs. Boise State has furloughed professional staff. They're in the process of doing the same with faculty. It's affecting enrollment. You know, colleges and universities in Idaho, they didn't see a huge drop off in enrollment. And we were talking back in the spring, we were talking about would colleges and universities see enrollment drop by 20%, a catastrophic decrease in enrollment with, you know, extreme impacts on the budget. Well, that really didn't happen, but you still saw some drop offs in enrollment, especially with Idaho high school graduates deciding whether to continue their education and go straight to college. Those numbers decreased, and that's a concern for colleges and universities going forward. And, you know, the process of just reopening for the fall and trying to stay open for the fall, and actually all of the colleges and universities in the state, they pulled it off. You know, it wasn't easy. Boise State looked pretty seriously at times about whether they could continue face-to-face learning. University of Idaho had to quarantine a bunch of fraternity and sorority houses as they had an outbreak. BYU-Idaho talked about closing or going online in the wake of reports that some of their students were trying to sell COVID-contaminated plasma, a bizarre story that unfolded in the fall. Northwest Nazarene University actually did a stay-in-place order for a week. So through all of that, the colleges and universities managed to stay open through the fall semester. Now the question is where we go in 2021. Will colleges and universities, they're going to try to reopen and welcome students back in January. Will they be able to pull it off and see it through?
And then with this, we talked in the earlier segment about the economy and how it was adversely affected. But Jimmy, talk to us about where we are budget-wise with the state of Idaho, because as Kevin just mentioned, I mean, there, you know, 5% cuts and, you know, and other cuts across state agencies, yet we're looking fairly okay.
We're looking fantastic compared to most other states in the country. That 5% cut, which the governor implemented in current fiscal year spending through an executive order back in July, that's about $200 million just for context. And that's on top of that 2% cut that I mentioned toward the top of the hour to all state agencies aside from K through 12 education. And so really, you know, this is kind of an interesting story, because that 2% cut, really, the budget writers for the state have really rallied around that as, well, the Little administration has, you know, it obviously wasn't for a pandemic recession, but it was for some kind of recession to try to, you know, maybe tighten the belt a little bit and have some money in reserve should something like this happen. And they had been socking away wheelbarrows full of cash into Idaho's rainy day fund for years. It's one of the most well-funded in the country. Estimates are around $600 million in across the various rainy day funds will be there by next July. But what was remarkable is that we didn't really have a gigantic hit in tax revenue like most other states. I mean, you look at Wyoming, they're staring down a 20-25% cut to their revenue. Obviously, Wyoming is very different and reliant on extraction industry for a lot of their revenue. But, you know, collections have beat out forecasts every month so far, including one that was released today. And if all of that bears out, keep in mind, we still have several more months left to go. We're looking at a $500 million surplus. That's billion with a B by the end of the fiscal year in June. But the thing is, some people do see a problem with that because Little restored some of the cuts made to K through 12 education with federal relief money. But other state agencies are living with their reduced funding. You know, like Kevin mentioned, colleges and universities are still furloughing employees, including here at Boise State, which holds our broadcast license. Faculty members I've spoken with don't understand why the governor hasn't restored some of the cuts since, you know, furloughed employees, they're not going to be able to, you know, go out and support the economy as much as other people who haven't had to deal with that. So, you know, the governor, when I've asked him this, said that he hasn't ruled out some kind of help. He's never offered anything specific and basically kind of left it up to the Joint Finance and Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee when lawmakers come back next month.
And then, Dawn, on top of this, I mean, part of this reason why we're looking so good is, frankly, the real estate market. And I think this might be surprising for a lot of people, but it never slowed down this past year.
What a wild year, both for the sales of new homes, but also rental units across the state. The prices just keep going up. The number of new homes available is very low, and that means that it's hard for people to move. Idaho has long been a destination for folks that are from other regions of the country for all the reasons that you can think of. But this year's been especially acute, as you've seen a lot of large employers say, hey, you know what? If you don't want to live here in our home base, wherever that may be, that's fine. You can telework and you can go work somewhere else. We might adjust your salary or we might not. And so if you're a wage worker, or not a wage worker, if you're just any type of worker, and you are thinking, boy, you know what, I think it's time to go somewhere else, and you Google places to live or good places to live, chances are Boise's going to wind up on your list. And what that does is it makes houses more expensive for everybody to buy. And that's shown up in the data every single month this year, except for one. We have seen the median price of a new home in Ada County go up. We're also seeing, like I mentioned, the prices of apartments and rentals go up, and that's causing some pretty significant challenges for people. Boise Dev's Margaret Carmel did a great story in September that looked at the average median income over the last 10 years and compared that to housing prices. And if you take your two hands and you put one flat and you point the other one kind of up at a 45 degree angle, that's what it looks like. Your flat hand is the wages, and the 45 degree angle hand is the price of a home. And so we're seeing a significant gap that's widening there, and that's causing some pretty significant challenges for people here living in the Valley.
We're going to have more with our reporter roundtable, but first, another story we covered in 2020. During the COVID pandemic, people and groups protested everything. They're still protesting everything from wearing masks to staying away from playgrounds. Sarah Brady was arrested for trespassing at a park in Meridian and told people to call the Idaho Freedom Foundation. Let's take
a
listen.
Told you, exit the playground area. It's
but we're not trespassing. Yes. Are you going to not really fight everyone for not social distancing?
Ma'am.
Are you going to?
More Idaho Matters next. More with our end of year reporter roundtable. Rebecca, we touched on this a bit about protests and people protesting mask mandates, protesting stay home orders. Talk a little bit about that, because this is something that now these protesters are going to health boards, and it is becoming a bigger and bigger issue as we are going into winter. And frankly, our hospitals cannot keep up.
Right. So remember back when the governor issued that stay at home order back in March, when this is all started, and we were all kind of terrified, frankly. The whole point of that was to maintain healthcare capacity, right? You can't treat sick people if you can't staff your hospitals, if you don't have enough hospital beds, like it just becomes an issue. Well, as the pandemic progressed over the course of the year, the governor said, you know what, I'm going to just, when it comes to whether regions need mask orders or whether other things need to happen, I am going to let our regional public health districts decide those issues. And each of those districts are run by a board, right? So that's a lot of county commissioners serve on the board. It's usually one person from each county in the district and then a few others. There's a couple medical professionals, or in some cases just one on each board. But it's really just representatives from the community, right? It might be your your local rancher slash commissioner. It might be, you know, who's to say? It's like local commissioners and health professionals. So they have been left to make the decisions on, like, do regions need mask mandates? Do we need to try to do other steps? And that has been probably the one of the biggest public health fights in Idaho for a while. In do people need to wear these masks? Health professionals and experts have said, look, this definitely slows the spread of the virus, but these boards have been really, really reluctant to enact any sort of mask mandate. And that's because there's a lot of opposition, but the opposition that's there is like a very, very vocal opposition. We saw this in Twin Falls. We've seen this at Central District Health. We've seen this at Southwest District Health. The people who are really willing to go to these meetings and try to protest are people who don't mind being in crowds, right? So you have a lot of folks who are very anti-mask, who maybe don't believe in the science that that it is all the experts are relying on during this pandemic, saying like, it's my face, I can do what I want with it. And that's made our health districts pretty reluctant. And frankly, many members of the various health boards are also themselves kind of anti-mask or, anti-government steps to sort of force people to slow the spread here.
I wanted to bring Mike into this too, because Mike, another issue that we saw when it comes to health, it is mental health. And we have seen, you talk about a surge, it is the record number of calls coming in to our suicide hotline.
That's right. We've been talking with the Idaho Suicide Prevention Hotline since the beginning of the pandemic. And there are a few different aspects to it. You have, they said that the majority of their calls, or a higher number of calls than typical, are from people who have actually maybe slipped into some sort of substance abuse, or had a history of substance abuse and slipped back into it, which I think kind of adds up based on just anecdotal evidence and the experience of a lot of people who are going through this. People are isolated. People are, especially seniors, are going through a tremendous amount of fear, all while not having access to their typical safety networks, the people that they would rather or typically run into, not to mention family and loved ones and those types of support systems. So they've seen record number of calls. We've followed it closely to see the numbers of suicides and self-harm and things like that. And we've seen an uptick. At this point, we haven't seen anything that's directly related to the pandemic or something that kind of jumped out at us as a headline. But there's enough smoke to suggest that there's a larger fire. And the longer you're doing this, the worse. You know, I heard somebody suggest at the very beginning of the pandemic, I was listening to a podcast, and there was a psychologist who said that we are living off the interest of relationships we built before the pandemic. And at this point, the interest is starting to wear off, and we're going to start removing principal. And that's going to be the really big issue, is when those relationships start to erode. And hopefully we avoid it. Hopefully, because of where we've gone since March, hopefully where we're heading, we're able to avoid another major shutdown and maybe this time next year.
Well, I want to thank all of you for all of the reporting that you do, everything that you've done throughout the entire year. We covered a lot. It was good to actually look back and to know that there was news before COVID. And before I wrap it up, very quickly, I'm going to put all of you on the spot. And I want, and you can use the same word, but one word that you would describe 2020. Kevin, I'm going to start with you.
I don't want to use unprecedented. That's become a music cliche. Chaotic. I mean,
Mike. Yeah, chaotic. Yeah, Mike. You.
I mean, my word is unprecedented. I know it's not popular, but oh my goodness, have we used that a lot?
Rebecca.
Two words, so long.
James, what about you?
I'm going to take a two-word liberty to dumpster fire.
Good one. Don?
I'm going to go with two as well. Changing, and I will always say hopeful.
And Scott?
Well, James stole mine. It was a dumpster fire.
Oh, man. Right. Looking forward to 2021. Again, though, thank you to all of you. Our year-end reporter roundtable, Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News, Mike Sharp, executive producer with Idaho News 6, Rebecca Boone, supervisory correspondent with the Associated Press Boise Bureau, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, Don Day, founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Scott McIntosh, the opinion editor at the Idaho Statesman. I don't think I have one word, but it would be trying to work from home with kids running into your show. Wow. It's parenting in 2020. That's mine. Parenting.
Joey, get your iPad.
Joey, get your iPad. Stop. Parenting in 2020. Thank you guys so much. Looking forward to 2021. I want to thank all of our listeners as well. Thank you for being a part of our program and for supporting us. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Have a great weekend.